Welcome to SharePoint at Microsoft Subject Matter Expert, or SME Roundtable. Hi, I'm Sherry Bettine, and I'll be your host. We are the IT Showcase team, and we talk to you, our customers, about how Microsoft does IT. I'm here with several of our SharePoint experts that are here to talk to you and answer your direct questions about how we do SharePoint at Microsoft. This is your opportunity to talk to our SMEs. You can submit your questions now through the live Q&A window, and I also have your questions that you submitted ahead of time that I'll be pulling from. We're going to first go around the room and introduce our SMEs. Jim, will you start?
Hello, I'm Jim Adams, Business Program Manager at Microsoft IT.
Hi, my name is Sam Crutzen. I'm a Program Manager here in MSIT, working on Delve and Enterprise Search.
And I'm David Johnson. I'm a Program Manager with accountability for our strategy and architecture solutions.
I'm Pam Green. I've been a Business Program Manager focused on taxonomy and metadata in SharePoint.
And I'm John Norris, a Program Manager that works on several publishing and team sites, including the Microsoft Library one featured in this course.
We are going to make every effort to get through all of your questions in this session, but if we don't, we're going to stay behind in the studio after the hour and continue answering your questions. And then this video will be posted with the extended footage on our website, Microsoft.com/IT Showcase. So let's get started. First question to Jim. What was the most difficult part of moving our sites to the cloud?
Probably one of the most difficult areas was just getting a handle on just how much stuff there was. Just knowing how much we had to move and being able to prioritize it according to readiness for a move, just size of the site collections themselves, and just organizing. So the migration to the cloud had to become a project unto itself, and we had to prepare the users, the owners of the site collections, through communication, through preparation. So just getting a handle on our inventory was one of the biggest challenges. Sam, you might want to...
Yeah, I'd say that in addition, Jim, that a lot of the work that we did was around cleanup. You know, why move something if you don't have to? So try to identify those sites, get rid of those sites if at all possible. Number two, find the feature mismatches, because while the SharePoint gap has closed between on-prem and in the cloud, there are feature differences. And so identifying those sites that are using functionality that doesn't exist in the cloud, Power Pivot, thank you. Identifying those sites and making sure to leave those behind was critical to our success.
Yep, and the first phase of that is always going to be taking an inventory so you know what you have.
Exactly.
Yep.
And did we also ask people to clean up their stuff? So not only probably your team's assets, but was there a lot of cleanup across the org?
Absolutely. So part of the communications plan was to ask the site owners to self-identify and delete sites if they're no longer in use, and that might be a good segue to talk about auto sites as well. We have a tool internally that goes through and manages lifecycle of site collections.
Yeah, I think a big part of this was our desire to get as many employees on the cloud as quickly as possible and start fresh. Anything net new, go to cloud. New team site, new project, go build it on cloud. But then have lifecycle management in place to say what has been abandoned from the on-prem environment, and so we can go could basically do that cleanup and not have to carry forward to Jim and Sam's points.
Did people easily give up their stuff?
I think from the time we opened the doors, basically it was about a year from the time we opened the floodgates and said net new site creation is going to cloud from the default states. It took about a year before we really started to drive migrations in a more critical way. And within that year, 50% of our portfolio was eliminated on-prem. And so... 50%. So it wasn't really that hard, because people, I think, especially going to cloud, you see new capability, you take advantage of new opportunities, you can get access off corp. it changed the dynamic for our employees.
Yeah, we used it as a carrot.
Exactly.
For them to go to the cloud. And we opened up brand new site collections in the cloud. You, if you want these features, here's your new site. If you want to use your old content, move it yourself.
Right.
And they're not going to move stuff that is old and antiquated and rubbish. They're only going to move the things that are living, breathing documents that they're working on now. So it was kind of self-correcting, and they just abandoned and the old stuff, and we blew the old site collections away.
And there was also a discouragement to a certain degree to stay on-prem, because one of the things we consciously did is we didn't actually upgrade our on-prem at the same pace. Like, we normally would upgrade our on-prem environment very quickly. Like, we're first and best customer, we upgrade very, very quickly for most part. But we purposely and consciously chose to keep things behind on-prem for a first while because we wanted to say, you want the latest capabilities, go to cloud to get them. And then, yes, now our on-prem environment is, again, both up to date as well as kind of advanced where we were. But it was the initial stage of saying we really want to encourage that self-migration.
And the self-migration was the initial phase of multi-phase
approach.
So the whole thing didn't run just by
people taking
themselves.
That was only roughly 50% of our portfolio was self-migration.
Yeah, yeah.
The other 50% was between forced migration, where we call it lift and shift, where we actually moved the site and we did the work to move them, and roughly 25,000 sites were moved that way, or where we had to refactor and rebuild it, such as the portal that John talks about.
Yep.
Yeah, and in the beginning, the migration tools weren't really ready yet. We were working with partner organizations, partner companies, in development of these tools. So in the beginning, we didn't have the tools to do these forklift migrations. So it was months in the making, scheduling all of these massive site migrations, mm-hmm. and people are impatient. We opened up site collections in the cloud, and they moved themselves, and it reduced what we had to move ourselves,
an
IT organization.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
So it worked really well.
So I think our next question is an extension of that. How do you manage personal SharePoint sites?
So OneDrive for business sites. So first of all, anybody in the company, any employee, or really anyone with an account in our corporate network can get a OneDrive for business site. You just go there, and we automatically provision them one. When that account is gone from the company, the cleanup job runs to retire that site, basically transfer ownership to the manager, and they've got a certain period of time when the manager can pull anything off that they need to. Or if that content needs to be under some sort of retention, maybe it's under litigation hold, for example, we can hold the site and keep it from being deleted at that point too. But from the time the site is created until the time the employee leaves, that employee really has accountability to their content. And we do hold that employee accountable. So wherever the employee is sharing, for example, if I'm sharing externally and that's allowed, we know it and the manager may know it and they're held accountable for doing it wrong.
Right. So if they're oversharing.
If they're oversharing.
Then their manager gets an email about it.
Well, when you turn on external sharing on a site, we flag that site and send notification to the manager not because it's a bad thing. There are perfectly viable scenarios where the external sharing is the right thing to do, but you want someone to have accountability
visibility.
Exactly. That's all this is.
Yeah.
Is our when you think about our kind of guiding principles, it's empower our employees, but at the same time equally protect our assets and hold our employees accountable when they don't do the right thing.
Trust but verify.
Exactly.
Right. Isn't the OneDrive for Business corpus the largest that we have?
It's
like
huge.
200 terabytes by now?
Last I checked, it was over 375.
375.
It was a huge amount of content.
That's incredible. Because in the beginning, when we had my sites on premises, it was
8 terabytes.
Yeah, it was tiny in comparison.
Yep.
But once we got into the cloud and people realized that they could access their assets, their personal assets, their personal corporate assets from their phone, their tablet, from the kiosk, at the airport, from Starbucks, wherever, the usage just skyrocketed.
Yeah. And the other part of this is it got things off of the machine that historically people were tied to device. A document would be there, or maybe they were using IntelliMirror or MyDocs or something else to replicate the documents. But generally, the documents were tied to the machine. Now, yes, I'm able to work on the device that I'm working on. I'm able to reflash my laptop because I want to, or whatever, change out my phone, no big deal.
I love that.
Yep, and that actually helps with a lot of business processes too for the library side. You mentioned earlier external sharing, and they actually have gotten rid of a lot of the older tools like FTP and the old extranet. And they're actually shifting to that model instead to work with content vendors outside the company. It makes things a lot easier and streamlined.
And just to add on to that point, John, I would add a plug for our product group partners who have built some excellent new auditing functionality. So for those who have concerns about their employees sharing with external users and colleagues, there's a whole bunch of new auditing functionality built in at protection.office.com. And really, that's a site where you can go and find out when a user has changed their sharing, added external partners and whatnot. And so that way you don't have to be as concerned, or when you're in an investigation mode, then you're able to find out who shared content with whom.
Yeah. And as a company, you can choose to turn on sharing or not. You can choose the level of control you want. So in our case, initially, we did not turn on external sharing, and then we decided we had the controls in place, and then we did, for example. But then even there, you can turn it on more granularly. So you can say, this site collection has external sharing turned on versus this other one does not.
Right. And you do that through the admin.
Yeah, and we, in fact, open that up so our employees can, at least at site creation time, select, I want to be externally shared. The only time we don't do that, we don't allow external sharing without a security review, is on a top secret site, what we call HPI.
Okay, great. John, let's go to the library.
Sure.
Why do search results on the library portal look different than standard search results?
Okay, so we actually chose, or the business actually chose, to display additional metadata elements or properties. For example, books have a lot of other things that other documents want, obviously the same ones like title and author, but they have things like book covers, different key custom subjects, not necessarily tagging like in PAM's Orb, but library subjects. And so we actually want to give the users a different feel right up front to make them visually different, and also to give them more information that they can use right away without having to get into the detail page. Mm-hmm. We also have those additional elements on the detail page which are using pulling from search as well. So in some cases, like if you're just indexing a file, like a general enterprise search, the title of the file and the highlight in context description suffices, especially with the hover panels that are nice there. But in our case, we actually want to give them some additional properties, some things like date. Like the libraries use date differently than the system modified date or create date. They actually have a thing called publish date that our users really want to sort on and they really want to see. So that's one reason why we do that. And also, you can do things like different styles, different brands. So if your team wants to present their results in a different way, say you want to do it as a grid, you could do that too, all using display templates that are you just build them in your SharePoint site, and you can make your results look however you like.
And there's many other scenarios. Books is a great example of that, and the content that's highly managed in library. But you can do it with news content. Mm-hmm. You could do it with training content, as we've done in our search too, where there's certain metadata elements, like John's pointing out, like a level of a training, or a duration of the training, or a target audience for a news story, for example. Those can all be, you can do the same thing there.
Yep. And then you can pivot on the search results and say, I want to refine by level 400 training, for example.
Exactly. Yeah, yep.
Exactly.
And with books, there's type of books. There's
e-audio,
e-books, and
different
audio
formats,
and
courseware, training, we have those, all kinds of facets that you can use. Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Yep.
Great. Sam, has Microsoft adopted Delve internally, and if so, how do we use it?
Yeah, it's a fair question. So I guess the first answer is yeah, Microsoft uses Delve. We rolled it out a little bit more than a year ago, prior to release, and the product group used that as their first venture into this notion of what they like to call at the time serendipitous discovery. It was a way for users to find out what their colleagues were working on. When that rollout occurred, it spurred a user wave of feedback that, suddenly all this content that they thought was shared, only to their friends or maybe even private, was suddenly showing up in Delve. And so, the early feedback was, oh my goodness, why is this showing up? And
so things showed up in places that they shouldn't have.
Exactly, and I don't know, perhaps folks out there are experiencing the same. The product group took this feedback, combined it with a lot of telemetry that they had on in terms of how users were using Delve here at Microsoft, and they used it to inform the next wave. And I'll put a plug in for the product group who is rolling out, even as we speak, the version 2 of Delve. And really, what we're seeing it here is a transition. So Delve today used primarily as a discovery tool. What the new version of Delve really makes it easy to do is to answer that question, where was I working on that? You know, I know I can, you know, edited a document that someone else sent me. Where was that? It'll show you the documents that you worked on.
I don't remember where it was saved. That happens to me.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know where it was saved. Great. Delve will show you that. Or, hey, I'm preparing for a meeting with John. Let me catch up on what he's been working on. Mm-hmm. It shows you a way to really focus in on John and kind of get the lay of the land and find out what his priorities, what his interests, what his job has him doing at this time. And then finally, and this is the part that I think is very exciting, at least internal here at Microsoft, is it shows what's going on in the network. So staying with my John example, not only do I get to see what John's working on, but I get to see what's going on within his network, you know, the employees that he collaborates with, shares emails with, and so on.
But what about those documents that were showing up where they shouldn't have been?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm glad you brought me back to that. So the product group took that feedback very seriously, and they've introduced new visual cues in the product, which tell you when content is widely shared. It'll show a little padlock when it's a private document, so that way you don't...
So you can see it, but
exactly.
You know you can't get to it.
Exactly.
Okay.
It's interesting. When fast search, when search was introduced in SharePoint, we had the same user reaction. Mm-hmm. They'd do a search, and they'd see all these things in their search panel that they didn't realize was exposed, and the stuff that even was secure, they saw and assumed that other people, when they searched, would also see. But search is security trimmed to your eyes only, so you'd see, you know, both your secure and unsecure documents. But it was interesting that Delve caused the same reaction in the user base as the original search.
A little bit of panic in the beginning.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then you know it's safe and secure because it's permissioned.
Exactly. So I guess the lesson there is, you know, as with enterprise search, make sure your content is locked down, that it's secured to just the people who should see it, and that'll make sure it only shows up in Delve for those who can and should see the content.
Now you have the visual cue to so that you can confirm.
Absolutely.
Okay. Great. Very cool. Pam, a little bit on taxonomy. Why not use just enterprise keywords instead of taking the time to develop a full taxonomy and content types?
That's a good question, actually. And it falls a little bit on the Delve scenario that tags and hashtags are definitely a part of the Delve experience. And the pros about hashtags or a flat keyword list is that it's really accessible. Hashtags are ubiquitous in a lot of the social networking sites and tools out there, so people are familiar with it, so they can pick up on it right away and understand that they're providing some sort of category for themselves. It tends to be a good micro solution, so in Delve I might want to hashtag items that are just for my particular need or my particular team or a V team need that's maybe very short term. When you want to start moving into using more structured taxonomy and using a full managed term set and mapping that to a field is when you want to have more control over the content and you want to be able to do things like John was just describing. You want to be able to render more custom search results, for example, or be able to filter on something like David was mentioning. Because if I have just a big, the two major downsides of the hashtags and the flat keyword list is that it is just a big flat list. And so I can't target on, say, a product name for this particular filter, or I want this web part to just bring back things that are for the SharePoint product, tag with SharePoint product.
Because it's not so controlled.
Right. It's just if I have a taxonomy that's product names and then a field that's mapped to that's product names, then I can be very specific about that in my configuration. Go to this field, look for this value, bring me back that stuff.
And you're not going to get a lot of different variations on the same name.
Right, and that's the second thing that's the downside of just a big hashtag or flat list is that you can get everyone can put whatever they want in, which is the beautiful democratization of that. The flip side is that I may put in SP 2016, Jim puts in SharePoint 2016 or SharePoint Server 2016, then, you know, Sam comes along and misspells it, and and so we have three variations on the same concept. And
so hard to aggregate that.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And as a consumer of that on some of our team sites, which she's actually familiar with, it also helps you when you want to change something officially, it cascades down through. If you're reusing terms, you don't have to go back and retag everything. If you're subscribing to that taxonomy, it should cascade down and update all of your content without you having to go through and read.
A good example of that are project names.
Yes.
They have secret, you know, code projects, and then when the product's released, you have all this content that needs to be changed. You can just change it at a higher level. And it's done.
Exactly. But then the downside to using just enterprise keywords, why even democratize at all?
Why not just not use keywords?
Why not just use keywords?
Oh,
enterprise keywords.
It's a similar construct as with the hashtags. The keywords are just a big flat list.
Okay.
You know, hashtags is sort of the more recent iteration of that same concept, but the keywords are a similar thing.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right. Next question for you, David. Do you have single sign-on on your on-premises and cloud environments?
Yes, in fact, we have the same. The nice thing about Office 365, it uses the Cloud Active Directory, the Azure Active Directory, which is a replication of the on-prem Active Directory. So all accounts are replicated from our on-prem to cloud with, so the employees, it's a completely seamless experience. In fact, if I'm on CorpNet, they never even get prompted again for credentials. They simply automatically sign into our cloud environment, our Office 365. If I'm at home, I will use exactly the same credentials, but because I'm not connected to our corporate network, I'll be challenged for the multi-factor authentication. But in every other way, it is exactly the same as if I was using my on-prem Active Directory, and it is completely seamless from that perspective. And we are encouraging our employees, and we're not encouraging, we're driving our employees to, as a requirement, to have multi-factor authentication pretty much across the board now, especially now that our content is in the cloud available on every device. The flip side to that is we want to protect that content, and we want to make sure that that employee is, since it's not connected to the network anymore, who they say they are, which is why the second factor, and we use phone factor to do that today predominantly.
Where is that mastered, the Active Directory?
Or is it today we master our Active Directory on-prem, and we replicate the directory to the cloud. We also, for groups, which is a new Office 365 groups, it starts in cloud and gets replicated back to prem.
Interesting.
Okay. Was it hard to get that all set up?
Interesting question. actually, Sam, why don't you take that one?
I think we would want to recognize that the folks who set it up are not sitting with us here today.
So it was easy.
Yes, it was easy. We just had to consume it.
That's right.
I would summarize in this way. In close partnership with the Azure product group, they went through several versions of DirSync, and now they're on Azure. What's the new name? Well, whatever the latest version of DirSync is. And they've certainly gone through several iterations to get there. They ran into some challenges around, and this is, I think, relevant to this discussion, is, there are limitations around group size. So a security group, can't have more than, is it 15,000 users, Tim, or 10,000?
I don't recall.
You can't synchronize very large groups to the cloud, and that's a challenge that we've had to work around. But really, in terms of how hard the work was, that was actually something we just consumed.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. But it's important to do.
Yeah.
Oh, no, it's the foundation. Customers, right?
Yeah. And it's the foundation across the suite. This isn't just about the SharePoint conversation. This is Exchange or any of the other 365 products. Mm-hmm. Really, you want an integrated authentication experience, and your best way to do that is use the Active Directory, even Cloud Active Directory, to manage all your authentication.
And it was an effort between our networking team, our identity and access management teams, and the product group to make all that happen.
And it can be even consumed outside of the Office 365 suite. It's the same Azure Active Directory that are consumed for, their teams internally that still have to roll their own .NET apps. And they can authenticate against the same directory store.
Yep, same tools as our customers are using.
Yep.
And it makes it very easy for employees. I love it. Jim. how do you manage storage quotas?
In the past, we used to manage it through the built-in SharePoint quotas and quota templates. And when you provisioned a site collection, you got X number of gigabytes to start with. If you ran out of space, you'd call the help desk. They were empowered to up your ante to one gig, then 5 gigs, then 10, then 25, or something like that. And that was for our on-premises SharePoint environment. And it was work intensive. It cost a lot of money to maintain and manage all that. When we moved to the cloud, we thought we would have a similar system. But in the cloud, we're using a different kind of storage, where you don't have to allocate the storage and pay for that storage unless you're using it. So if you have, say, 1 gig of storage block, and you're only using 5 megs, you only have to pay for 5 megs. And when you reach this imaginary quota limit, it stretches and you can use more than your 1 gig that you thought you had. So there is no quota in the cloud to a certain extent. We have 1 terabyte that's available to each site collection, each person's OneDrive for Business. So in essence, we have 1 terabyte per unit. But we don't have to pay for that 1 terabyte. We only pay for how much we're using.
And we cross-charge here?
We do cross-charge, yes. It's in our Microsoft Monopoly money, but it does cost IT a certain amount of money to have SharePoint licenses. Yeah. And that license includes X number of gigs of storage. So today, in Office 365, we don't really have to manage quotas like we did before, and it's a cost that we can avoid.
Right. Because that was one of the major help desk ticket volume. Yes,
exactly. A majority of the help desk tickets were for things like, you know, I want to get more storage. And it's allowed us to save quite a bit of money in that realm.
And the thing I would add there is, you know, while we've enabled the automatic quota management, you know, it's not hard for me to imagine that there are scenarios where people still want to manage quotas on a per-site basis.
Yeah.
And I just want to kind of note that that's still present in the product those companies that want to do that. Now here at Microsoft, it was a major cost driver, and so turning that off was a big win for us.
Do we let employees know if they're being hogs with space? I mean, I used to get alerts that my email was filling up and I needed to go empty the trash and do all that kind of maintenance thing. I don't remember getting one of those lately.
Well, now you only get one. I mean, a terabyte, for certainly on the SharePoint side, you know, that's where we're at from a default perspective, and because that's the max and today, and so you would get notification when you get really close to that. So yes, we do notify, but that said, the numbers are so much higher than where people are normally at. Mm-hmm. It's less of an issue. We really don't want our employees to have to deal with that level of back and forth of IT to say, okay, I need more quota. We'd rather them just get their work done and manage it that way. And by the way, the 1 terabyte quota, the product is now announced that they're going up to 5 terabyte is the max now size. So
you can
choose to turn that on if you want and up. In our case, we're still using 1 terabyte, but if we chose, we could up it to 5.
Can you target what you turn up, or is it kind of a whole tenancy sort of thing?
Yeah, we can target to either site collections. By default, it would be turning it on to a whole, you know, everything. For example, all OneDrive for Business sites, but you can target.
Okay.
Wow.
Yeah. Imagine when my sites was 8 terabytes total, and now we can give an employee 5 terabytes for just one.
I'm imagining.
Yeah. We never have to clean up ever again.
Well, I wouldn't say that.
I don't go there.
Okay. So what? I mean, it feels right to kind of clean the garage and clean up. What's going to cause me as an employee to need to do that?
Relevancy. We're still searching and we're indexing all that stuff. And it comes to the point where you're sifting through too much stuff that's just old and antiquated. So.
Just like when in your garage, when you go to look for the barbecue tongs come May, and you can't, there's too much stuff in there. You don't know which box it's in, and that's our internet ends up.
So we'll be self-motivated.
I think there's more than that. I mean, in the product, there are retention policies we can choose to turn on.
Mm-hmm.
We're actually a little lax on that.
Yeah.
While we use Record Center today, and legal, our legal partners have a retention and content gets moved into Record Centers where it needs to be, that's very tightly controlled content, for example, contracts or other things that really have a very tight retention policy around it. We have retention more broadly, and we just don't necessarily enforce that of a tenancy level today. We could. We can flip the switch and say, I'm going to require the content tagged like this has this level of retention to it, for example.
And we are still governing content.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And that, I think, has been pretty effective.
Yeah, and because we typically govern today, what we've learned is we govern at the container level as opposed to the content itself. Because we one of those guiding principles of empowering our employees means getting out of their way as best we can. So I'd rather you classify and manage that site collection than you having to tag every individual piece of content on that site. And yes, in some cases, like a more managed repository, we're absolutely going to require that you tag every piece of content. But for the masses, the team sites, the team collaboration or project scenarios, we would say, you know, I'm not going to get in your way. I'm going to force you tag and manage at your project level, but not within that.
Okay. And then we also call out like other things where we could say we want to make sure you review. So you'll get notifications, just not for necessarily for space, but like if your site's approaching out of date or if you've enabled external
exactly.
sharing,
read expiration.
So you want to go review who you're sharing with. So you can get your customers or your to review certain aspects.
And it lets me be really passive as an employee. Yeah. If I'm like, I it's old, I don't want to deal with it. I just let it expire.
Let it expire.
Like David's saying, it stays out of my way, and I only have to take action if it's still content I want to keep. You know.
Yeah.
Okay.
And aside from protecting the search, it also protects the company. I mean, there are risks for any company in retaining content longer than is legally required.
Yeah.
You know, and so, you know, of course, we've got the highly managed repositories to stay in line with certain ISO compliance, requirements. But certainly, you know, for you know the unstructured, unmanaged content, we, you know, it's good for the company to get rid of that after the required timeline. So
great.
And it also benefits search in the process to go full circle.
Next question. This is probably for you, David. What is the app model for SharePoint Online? What is your recommended solution for developing applications on top of SharePoint Online?
So the cloud application model on top of SharePoint Online is where, unlike on-prem, where the applications were running on the SharePoint boxes directly, the new model says the application is, and the business logic is running out of the SharePoint process. It's either running in some provider like Azure, for example, or maybe AWS, or maybe some other IaaS server if it's an on-prem environment. But it's not running on SharePoint. And everything is going back to SharePoint via remote API calls, REST APIs or CSAM calls back to SharePoint to get access to that same data. And then integrating it through kind of provider integration whereby on my site I can just drop the app onto the site. And one of the things we have is we have an app catalog that we manage of all internal SharePoint applications. You submit the app to us, we review and we put it in the catalog, and then anyone can drop it on their site. But the nice thing now is that those applications are independent from the SharePoint environment, whereas on-premise, if my finance application could have stepped on my HR application, and so we would have separated that HR farm from the finance farm, for example, to make sure that that kind of thing never happened. In cloud, I don't have that issue because I've got one. I now have one tenancy for Microsoft IT that covers everything finance, all engineering teams, the whole company, and those finance applications can't step on those HR applications because they're running in providers that are completely independent of each other. So either they're running in that Azure provider or maybe they're running directly in a browser. Maybe I can just drop a part on a page. And Library, for example, has some great examples of provider parts that are either accessing your book catalog remotely or, you know, we have a glossary part that we have that which is a SharePoint provider part which just goes against the terms store to say, let's do a lookup quickly of what of terms I might be looking for.
Yep.
And there's benefits to doing that on-premises as well as in the cloud. So it's not just for the SharePoint Online environment. If people start developing that way and when we do that on-premises, then really helps upgrade, right?
Absolutely.
Because it's separated.
If the whole goal is decouple as much as possible and separate the applications from a SharePoint environment so they can be upgraded independently. One of the challenges historically of upgrading SharePoint has been the more heavily customized SharePoint environments, and the more you've got stuff installed directly on the SharePoint server, the harder it has been to upgrade that. With a newer model, even for on-prem, I can now more easily upgrade that SharePoint environment without worrying about breaking the applications or vice versa.
Yeah. And we've actually already used that approach when we migrated from on-prem to the cloud for the library site.
Yep.
We basically were a hybrid. We have an on-prem catalog server that he was talking about. That's a third-party library software package that a lot of libraries have. And so we interact from SharePoint through Azure to that. And we've already been able to reuse that, you know, in other places. So you don't have to, on the old thing, it was a very custom solution. You couldn't really port it anywhere without a lot of work. And now it's a lot easier to make reuse of those techniques and authentications.
And the thing I'd say, though, about the solution is just to keep it simple, because the models continue to improve and evolve, and the more complex the business solution is, the harder it is for that solution to grow and evolve with a business need or the changing technology underneath us. So
also, there's less of a need for that complexity because of all the features that are built into the product and all of the applications that have been bolted onto SharePoint from an Office 365 perspective.
Yeah. You get more out of box today
out
than
of
you
box,
ever got.
It's now incredible.
Right.
It started out humbly, but now SharePoint is a foundation where all these building block applications
and
have been added.
The simpler it is, the more you can take advantage of
Well, and I think what part of a challenge is, and it's always a balance of, you can either build a 100% perfect solution with a lot of custom development, and SharePoint and 365 will totally allow that. You can completely customize and build this really rich solution, doing anything you want. That, though, how are you going to then deal with changes to the business need after that? How are you going to do changes in the technology stack after that? It locks you in with a massively complex solution. And so, especially as we think about things like portal and publishing scenarios, we're trying to say, yes, when it comes to integration of other things, I want to build that customization and build that in place, like library catalog integration. But in other cases, I'm going to say, you know what, I'm not going to overly customize from a solution perspective. I'm going to try to use the product as best I can so that I've got the most flexibility for improvements down the line.
Yeah, and one of the lessons learned that we had back in the 2007-2010 era is groups had hired out to contractors to develop these really rich custom solutions that were then added to their custom properties, their custom SharePoint portals and things. But when it came time to upgrade, certain things broke because they used certain APIs that weren't supported, things like that. Were those contractors and third-party developers available to fix the code? No, they weren't. Did they provide documentation for others to fix the code if they weren't there? No, they didn't. So the upgrade from 2007 to 2010, for instance, took us about 18 months because of those customizations, those portals, those SPS sites at the time were so heavily customized. So there's a lesson learned there. Keep it simple, like David said, and customize if you absolutely need to, or you have a staff on hand that you will retain to keep up with the maintenance and the updates.
I'm going to move to the next question.
Okay.
Good information. Can you speak to how you use rights management with your on-prem and cloud SharePoint environments? Is that it, David, or?
I think I can probably talk to that
Sam.
One. So yeah, we connect our farms. We recently migrated from using an on-prem rights management provider to the Azure rights management provider. And we've connected all our SharePoint sites, whether internal or cloud-based, to consume from that Azure rights management provider. And users can, IRM protect a library. They can IRM protect the content and upload that to the library, and thus prevent content from being shared outside of the audience it's intended for.
And from our perspective, the IRM protection integration of SharePoint 365 was one of the factors that made us believe that and realize that we really could be secure in cloud, because if it really is top secret content, we're going to encourage that the owner, IRM protects that library, so that anytime someone downloads that content, it is rights protected.
Yeah, and we've discovered that the cloud is actually more secure than we were able to make our on-premises SharePoint environment, because the cloud has to be secure, and they have people that are dedicated to that security element to keep it safe. And we just didn't have that kind of bandwidth or staffing or funding on-premises with such a small staff to keep it as secure as the cloud is. It's truly a fortress out there.
Great. Next question. Do you automatically delete any content on SharePoint?
Do we automatically delete? We delete based on policy, a misallowance. So if someone, we do a few things, but we give, first of all, lots of warning. So if your site has expired, or maybe you failed to keep your site compliant. In other words, you have a top secret site and you have a security group that's everyone in the company have access to that site. Those are all things where we will flag the site as non-compliant. If you fail to take action on that site, either renew it or fix the failures, we will first of all lock the site, block access to it. That's kind of a first step, so people don't, we don't just delete. We give people time and say we're going to lock it. If after a period of time that site's locked and no one still has taken action, then the site will go into a soft delete state and in the recycle bin, basically, so that there's a period which it's then going to go soft delete, then the hard delete down the line, right? But we go through those stages of warning, this is going to go because these reasons, then we lock, and if you still haven't taken action, then we start the deletion process.
And it's more than one person that gets that notification,
yeah,
right?
It's anyone who is either listed as a site collection admin or we have on file as an owner of a site.
Okay, so lots of warnings, lots of time,
warnings,
and more than one person.
Yeah, but we do delete, and that's one of the reasons why the 50% of a content set was not needed to move to cloud, because we deleted 50% of a content set on-prem.
And that was the pro side I was talking about earlier, where I can be passive and they send me those and I just let it go because I know I don't need that content anymore.
Right.
And it just gets cleaned out for me.
Yes.
Okay.
Now, in cases where a site is on a legal hold, for example, or there's some retention around it, legal can put a block on that process that we have. And so that does exist, of course, if a contract site, for example, or whatever. But the basic process goes through that, and for example, team sites or project sites, or which have a vast majority of that big set of content.
So, David, the listeners and viewers might want to know, is that feature of expiring the sites and all that, is that built into SharePoint, or is that some stuff that we add?
So there are some capabilities in product that do some basic lifecycle, but the more advanced kind of classifying a site and putting an expiration policy around it and all that, we have built a custom solution around that. There are third parties that also have similar things. Our solution is actually now in Office Patterns and Practices on GitHub, on dev.office.com. So anyone can take a look at how Microsoft IT does governance and how we provision sites. There's a sample solution there in Patterns and Practices for provisioning sites, as well as a sample there on how to govern and put lifecycle in place on top of sites.
Okay, next question. Are there reasons why you would want to keep a SharePoint site on-premises?
Oh, lots of reasons. You could have business connectivity to systems that are not SharePoint, that are on-premises, that aren't in the cloud. And the only way to access those is through an internal intranet that can be refactored at a later time, but for the time being, that interconnectivity between that business system and your SharePoint site might be vital to your business. Might want to keep those on-premises. You might also simply want to have a reserve place for things that you don't feel comfortable putting into the cloud. Until you're comfortable putting it into the cloud, have it on-premises. In our case, we dog food on-premises solutions for our product group, so we keep a tiny portion of our assets on-premises so we can practice good dog fooding on that, as well as support our regional users that have a requirement to have their content actually in-country for sovereignty purposes.
Oh, yeah.
So with those sites, with the sites that we dog food with, that comprises 3%, 4% of our total SharePoint content. And the rest is up in the cloud.
Yep.
Well, that leads into the next question. How do you conform to data sovereignty requirements of EU and other countries that have that?
So we have three regional SharePoint environments. Mm-hmm. We have our US-based footprint, which is in the cloud today. We also have a US-based footprint on-prem for some of those sites that Jim was mentioning earlier that can't stay, that it makes sense to keep on-prem. We have a European footprint sitting in Dublin today. whereby we've got that for European countries, they all store in one central location, and we have an Asian footprint for that continent as well. So.
Okay, and then, so that's from our cloud-based solution?
No, that's from on-prem.
That's IT?
That's Microsoft IT, yeah. We host three variant regional SharePoint environments.
Okay.
Now, Office 365, they're springing up data centers all over the place. I recently went to Australia, and they have a data center in Sydney to take care of the requirement that some of the government and some
right.
of the customers that we have there keep their content on their continent. So we do it for there. We do it for various countries throughout the world to support.
To help with that data sovereignty.
To help with that data sovereignty. And more Office 365 or Microsoft data centers are popping up all over the place to support that requirement.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Next question. Do you use DLP with custom policy?
Yes, we do, in fact. First of all, we use DLP to scan the obvious things, like look for credit card numbers or social security numbers or things, patterns. And the team also looks for specific words of top secret projects, for example. They have policies that do that. And yes,
and DLP stands for
Digital Leak Prevention.
Digital leak prevention,
if I recall correctly. But yeah, it is the ability to basically look for that pattern of content that really we want to identify. Use a search underneath the seams to index all content and find what might be potentially a challenge, and notifies our security team when they can look through that and say this content potentially shouldn't be here. And we've turned on, one of the things they're starting to do now is actually turn on the next step of policy. So if I save a document up on a site with a credit card number, for example, I might be flagged with a DLP policy saying, hey, this document has this in it, you just be aware. And then at that time, we could do things like block the save completely, or we could allow it to happen in maybe certain locations. But those are things that we're now taking the next step to really turn on that notification at save time too.
Okay, and right now it's not notification at save time?
No,
after the fact?
Well, we've been doing notification after the fact, and one of the things our security partners are doing right now is actually doing it at save time as well.
Okay. And the notification, is it a pop-up or an email?
Basically,
later,
well, no, it's literally right in the experience. It'll say, there'll be a little UI tooltip saying, hey, this document, for example, has credit card number.
FYI, in case you didn't know.
Yeah, and then it could be stronger than that, and it's up to us as to how strong we want to react to that.
Okay, and that's the policy that we might pull together.
Right.
Okay.
But again, the out-of-the-box product has, I forget how many it was, 50, I know it's more. I know it's more now. But the basic policies, credit card numbers, passport numbers, stuff like that. But also then rules that we provide, like say, I want to look for code names.
Okay. Cool. How we keep our data safe.
Yeah. Oh, it's one of the layers of how we keep our data safe.
Yeah,
right?
One of the layers.
We've got many, yeah.
Yes. Okay. You talked a little bit about multi-factor authentication. Could you expand on that a little bit? Is it only through off-campus, or could you talk about the different times we do use?
So MFA, typically, I mean, we have a bunch of possibilities here. If I enroll my device and have a virtual smart card on the device, on a TPM chip on the device, I can use my virtual smart card as my second factor authentication. But that's, of course, only for devices that support the TPM chip and only for certain scenarios.
And that's transparent. Don't have to do anything.
Right. And if I'm off corp, if I'm off corporate network, I can therefore either point to that virtual smart card, or I can do a phone factor authentication, which in our case, you register some phone number with Microsoft internally and with Microsoft IT, and then you try to authenticate to something, and we do phone factor. Not only do you have to enter your username and password, but then you get a phone call back, and you have to enter your PIN.
Or optionally, the Azure Authenticator app.
Thank
so
you.
It'll come up just like a text on your phone, and you plug in your PIN, and that's your second factor.
Yep. Okay, and we've enabled it for all corporate assets, or?
Everything on 365.
Yep.
Okay, good deal. think we're getting close to the hour, and I want to make sure that I give our SMEs one more opportunity, one more question. So I'm going to ask you to think about what is the one tip you would like to leave our audience with today about SharePoint, about how we run SharePoint. What tip would you give our customers? And while you're thinking about that tip, I would like to ask our customers, we'd love your feedback on these sessions. So in your window, you will get a link to two survey questions, and we'd love to hear from you on how these sessions are resonating with you and what else you might like to see. So with that, John, would you take the first cut?
Sure. I would. One of my tips would be take advantage of search wherever you can. SharePoint has a great capability of exposing your content, getting it, making it discoverable, and sharing it with other people in your enterprise. So, for example, if you have, I'll speak for the library, if we have books that are specifically related to HR, you can actually work with HR to expose your content on their site with very minimal effort. So you can reuse your content, share it, and it's all through the power of search, and it's pretty straightforward. And we just love syndicating our content that way.
All right. And I would say, actually kind of building on that, if you are new to using managed metadata and content types, don't feel like you have to boil the ocean right away. We started out with some specific scenarios, and it may just track right on to what John just said. There may be an area where there's a great opportunity to share content, and you maybe create a content type and a managed taxonomy for that area and prove out a small success before moving on.
And I would say just open the door to the cloud. I mean, for those of you who haven't started the process, open the door where it may, do investigate, do diligence, but basically start dipping your toe in the water and open the door so people net new can get created in cloud. And for simple workloads, everything from OneDrive for business or simple team sites, because the sooner you get people actually provisioning those new sites in the cloud, then you get the network effect of saying, hey, I'm seeing this here, I'm able to use it, their peers want to use it, the other projects that people may be on want to go there as well. It starts to kind of cascade and minimizes migration to the cloud later on.
Okay, great. Sam?
Yeah, for me, I'm going to pick on my currently favorite topic, Delve. I would recommend that users re-explore the Delve functionality that's built into the product, especially as it's rolling across farms worldwide, even as we speak, so it'll come to a tenant near you. Really, it's a very powerful way to not only discover what's going on around you, around your colleagues, but also it's a great way to enhance enterprise search. You know, so kind of tagging on to what John was saying, not only does it return search items by relevance, but it adds that component of social distance, which is something we didn't mention earlier. It will boost those items in relevance worked on by people in your own network, and so give that a try, give that a whirl, and I think you'll be glad that you did.
Okay. Playing off of what David said, unless your core business is running SharePoint, take advantage of the cloud. You don't have to put all of your assets in the cloud. Put the SharePoint sites that have the least impact as far as being secret or high business impact to your business. Put your moderate and low business impact content in the cloud. Experiment with it. Have a hybrid environment where you keep your most vital assets still on premises until you get comfortable with the cloud. You don't have to. It's not an all or nothing thing. And like I said, unless it's your primary business running SharePoint, it frees up your IT resources to do more valuable things higher up the OSI stack that pertain to your actual your core businesses. So use SharePoint as a resource.
One thing I want to add to that, because Jimmy just brought up the whole hybrid, the customer's probably going to be in a hybrid state. Since we recorded the video, there's just been a lot of hybrid work done in product, and I just want to point out that between hybrid search and OneDrive for Business, hybrid pointing back, your on-prem environment being able to point to hybrid to OneDrive for Business in the cloud or Delve in the cloud, there's a lot of additional hybrid work now of 2016 that is worth investigating. And we're also a hybrid customer, and it's definitely something that we appreciate a lot of our customers are going to be in that same state and definitely worth looking into.
And adding on just even a little bit further, too, is the integration between the various members of the suite. We're seeing a lot of work there. Used to be, especially on-prem, you had the Exchange guys over here and you had the SharePoint guys over here, and maybe we'd throw some rocks at each other from time to time, but there wasn't really a lot of integration between the various parts of the suite. Mm-hmm. A lot of the effort going on right now, Delve among them, is really going around exposing data from different parts. So like Delve can show emails, it can show Yammer posts, and really that integration is very exciting.
Okay, wonderful. Well, I want to thank our SMEs for taking time away from your day jobs to come out and talk to our customers. And I want to thank you, our customers. We genuinely enjoy this opportunity to have a dialogue with you, answer questions, and really share the work that we do here in Microsoft IT. I would like to ask you to fill in those two survey questions so that we get your feedback on these sessions. And this video will be posted at our Microsoft.com WAC IT Showcase. We have events like these planned every month, as well as webinars on other topics. We have technical case studies, articles, productivity guides. We have a wealth of information available for you to help you with Microsoft technology at our Microsoft.com/IT Showcase site. So please visit it, and we hope to see you back. Thank you. Hi, everyone. This is the extended footage portion of the program. We have one more question we want to take on. What is your plan to move off of InfoPath?
Well, I'll take that one first, and I think David can add on. The first thing to note is the product group has committed to supporting InfoPath well into the 2020s. So there's some time yet. Obviously there's been some announcements about its premature death, and then it's for those who haven't already heard about it, then it's that death has been postponed. And so first off, anything that you build and have built will continue to work, for a number of years yet. What would you want to add on?
Well, I would add, first of all, we are, in fact, some solutions we still do build on InfoPath. There are reasons why it makes sense. Now, we're trying to minimize how much we're doing on InfoPath now. You're either building the form potentially directly in Azure, there's now the new Office Forms capability that's out that you can build on that. We're doing investigation of Power Apps and other approaches to build form solutions as well. So there's a number of paths we're trying to take to go deal with that. So we're in the process of, it's kind of early for us to say across the board how are we moving off of InfoPath. It really depends on the scenario. Some scenarios, if it's a simple form, as I said, we'll go to the Office Forms or move to other approaches. In more complex scenarios, you build a whole form in Visual Studio for Azure, for example. And so it just depends on what we're trying to do.
In the meantime, the product group isn't sitting still. They're working on some things that aren't ready to be discussed yet. So just know that there's other things coming in addition to the approaches that already exist.
Yeah, I'll call out forms.office.com, I think it is, that is another, is at least the genesis for an updated form solution as well, for at least the simple form development.
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
That's it. Thank you, guys. Thank you.